License number TX39066.
KTSA News Time, 6:38 on a Thursday night. Coming on the weekend. Before this half hour is up, we'll have the results on the Stevens Roofing JR poll. And a lot of people had really funny answers to that question today, so we'll talk about that here in a few. It's our Ask a Doctor segment, and we're joined tonight for your phone and email questions about coronavirus by Dr. Fred Campbell, Associate Professor of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, good evening. Thank you for being on with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
We had a question from... a listener named Charlie, who said, suppose you have the COVID-19 symptoms and you decide that you need to go to the hospital. Is there one hospital versus another that would be better for you to go to? Should that be a consideration?
In the metropolitan area in San Antonio, there are several excellent hospitals with the ability to take care of very sick patients, such as serious COVID-19 sufferers, the University Hospital, for instance, and all three of the private hospital systems have the capability of taking care of sick patients like that.
So there isn't one particular hospital that would be the one you should target?
No, I've worked in virtually all the systems in San Antonio, and I find them all to be superb. So you can pick and choose.
All right, 210-599-5555 with a question for Dr. Campbell. And Ilsa is on line number two with a question. Ilsa, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, what was your question? Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, so I have a scenario and then a question. So if the butcher is handling meat all day and he's carrying the coronavirus, and then we go and we purchase that meat and we take it home and we cook it, is the virus still in the food?
That's a very good question. Like with other microorganisms, if you cook to a certain temperature, and generally that's going to be 160 degrees, then virtually all microorganisms will be destroyed. So not only the COVID-19, but any other dangerous microorganism would be destroyed. So if you have a meat thermometer, for instance, you can make sure your meats are cooked adequately.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Ilsa. Appreciate that. It's a good question. So maybe for now, the best rule of thumb would be medium well or well until this is over, huh?
Excellent idea.
I was reading a story today, Dr. Campbell, from the journal Stat, and it was headlined with ventilators running out. Doctors say the machines are overused for COVID-19. It was doctors who are starting to, these are frontline critical care physicians, who are actually questioning the widespread use of ventilators, saying that they're finding they may be of less benefit than expected and even harmful to some patients. They went on to say that many patients they're seeing have blood oxygen levels so low that they should be in serious trouble, but they're not gasping for air, their hearts aren't racing, their brains are not showing signs of oxygen deprivation. First of all, have you heard anything about that? And second of all, what is your reaction to that?
I have taken care of patients on ventilators through my career, and I do know that there are certain levels of oxygen concentration in the blood that are considered to be critical. Now, certain individuals, certain patients may have a different clinical response to those levels. But there's no question that one needs to maintain a certain percentage of oxygen in the red cells. And so experienced clinicians that take care of ventilator patients know these things and are willing to certainly would look for limits of oxygen saturation that might be dangerous. There certainly are people that are very, very sick, may have chronic severe lung disease that would have great difficulty getting to those oxygen levels, even with high concentrations of oxygen or even ventilator care. But certainly ventilators are still the standard of care and are life-saving in virtually all situations like that.
Would this indicate, though, that maybe some patients could take or benefit from non-invasive support, something like we're familiar with if we have CPAP machines versus necessarily needing a ventilator?
Yes, there's no question that non-invasive techniques of oxygenation could be adequate to take care of a large number of COVID-19 sufferers. And we're fortunate that those techniques have been developed over the last several decades, so many patients don't have to suffer the discomfort of actually being intubated.
Let's take another question for Dr. Campbell here on KTSA. Rick on line number one, next on KTSA. Hi, Rick.
Hello, sir. How are you this evening?
Doing great.
All right, sir. My question is, I have a VPAP machine for apnea, sleep apnea. And my concern is, or my question is, can a formula or a preventative or even a vaccine of some sort be put into the reservoir and ingested over the period of sleep throughout the night? Wouldn't that be treating the lungs the way that the pressures are put in and pushed out?
Well, there actually are some medications that are delivered through the respiratory tree. However, in someone with COVID-19 at this point, it's unfortunate we don't have a specific agent that can be given either intravenously or orally or even through the respiratory tract that's been proven to be effective in helping get people through this infection. So there's no question that various forms of treatments are given in different ways, including through the respiratory tract. And there are microorganisms that respond to certain treatments that way. But unfortunately, so far, we haven't been able to find that with COVID-19.
Yeah. Rick, good question. Thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Dr. Campbell, I was also reading today, we heard Dr. Fauci talking about how there are several vaccine studies in the works, and we're all hopeful for them. One study that I was reading about was for a vaccine candidate being developed by Inovio Pharmaceuticals, and this one was what they described as a skin-deep shot rather than the usual jab. We know that there is also another vaccine that is being experimented with that involves almost a Band-Aid looking device with tiny little prongs that deliver the vaccine just under the surface of the skin. Why would it be significant how you deliver a vaccine versus just having one that's safe and can be produced quickly?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, particularly with this virus being relatively new on the on the picture. The vaccines that have been given to folks in the past have been given in lots of different ways, both intramuscular, subcutaneous, and actually there have been some vaccinations way back when I was given smallpox. We actually got the vaccine by pricking the skin. So depending on the type of response that the body develops to a vaccine, that will determine the way the vaccine is actually administered. So it could be any of a number of different ways, and we want to make sure that obviously we get the strongest antibody response to a vaccine.
When we hear experts say we could be 18 months away from a vaccine, I always wonder, do they mean 18 months to the day it's approved, or 18 months to the point after approval when it's been mass produced and is likely to be available at the at your local, you know, physician's office or wherever you get care?
I believe what they're really talking about is when it is going to be available on a universal basis for everyone to take advantage of. There's an awful lot of testing that goes on, but 18 months sounds like a typical kind of development and production timetable. So I think you could expect, if this is anything like previous vaccines, that we'll be getting that vaccine certainly within 18 months.
All right, Dr. Fred Campbell, UT Health, UT San Antonio Health. Appreciate the time and the visit with us tonight. I hope we can call on you again in the future, but thank you.
Be happy to. Have a good week.
It is 6:48, and coming up, the results on tonight's Stevens Roofing JR poll. We'll find out what you were saying about it here on